It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.rir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
That's the one that surprises people. The test is not whether you can't do the current job you have or jobs that you used to have. You've got to prove that. But the key and most difficult question is... Can you do any job that exists in the national economy in reasonable numbers? Can you do this job? And you have to prove that there's no job that you can do. And that can be difficult.
Disability attorney Charles Crumbine reveals what succeeds and does not succeed in a claim for disability benefits from the Social Security Administration. And during this week's News You Can Use, we analyze why Virginia had the largest drop in median income in the nation in the year 2012. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 216, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.rir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. Virginia experienced the largest decline in median household income of any state in 2012, according to new data released last month by the U.S. Census Bureau, and it's a trend that likely will continue due to cuts in investments by the federal government. According to the Commonwealth Institute for Fiscal Analysis, the census figures show that Virginia's median income fell over $1,400 in 2012, a drop of over 2%, landing at $61,741. Only one other state, Missouri, took a significant hit in 2012. While a handful of states had income gains, most of the country stayed flat. After adjusting for inflation, Virginia's median household income in 2012 was lower than it was in 2000. The pain was felt across the Commonwealth. In the Lynchburg and Roanoke metropolitan areas, household incomes fell by more than $4,300. For Lynchburg households, that was a drop of over 10%. No region of Virginia had a significant increase in household income. So, how did we get here? Well, for starters, Virginia's economy has benefited for decades from the federal government's large presence in the state, employing thousands of residents directly and indirectly through contract work. The federal government spends about $17,000 in Virginia for every resident in the state, which is one of the highest per capita levels in the country and almost double the national average. But this reliance on direct federal employment and federal contract work has put the Commonwealth at great risk. As the federal government shifted into austerity mode with the Budget Control Act of 2011, cuts to federal spending have caused disproportionate pain for the Commonwealth and hurt the well-being of families across the state. And it's a trend that is likely to continue, as the effects of across-the-board spending cuts that began in early 2013, often referred to as sequestration, are captured in future income data. Of the total job losses expected from across-the-board federal spending cuts in 2013, nearly 10% will come from Virginia, a share second only to California. It's easy to be distracted by Virginia's consistent ranking as one of the wealthiest states in the nation and by reports of rising home values. But this latest census data is a sobering reminder that working families in our state face real challenges. And as we recalibrate our economy to prepare for a leaner federal government, the state must be committed not only to growing jobs, but also growing prosperity. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the law offices of Charles Crumbine of Crumbine & Associates across the street from Willow Lawn Shopping Center, and we're going to be talking with him today about Social Security and SSI disability. Welcome to the show, Charles.
Well, thank you for coming to talk to me.
Would you tell our listening audience, first of all, exactly what is Social Security and SSI disability?
When you become too sick to work, the government might pay you some money. I say might because they have made the regulations and the rules confusing to even the best of people. It's a mess. There are two kinds of payments, Social Security disability. That is something that you earn by going to work and paying your taxes. And then there is Social Security Supplemental Income, SSSI. People say SSI, but there are actually three S's. SSSI is the safety net of welfare. You get some money. It's when you haven't worked, but you can prove under similar rules to Social Security disability that you cannot work even though you want to.
Now, how does somebody know that they have a good Social Security, or I'll call it SSI because that's what I typically do call it, SSI disability case?
Well, there are five things that the government must be convinced of. And I'm going to jump to number five, the last question, because that's the one that surprises people. The test is not whether you can't do the current job you have or jobs that you used to have. You've got to prove that. But the key and most difficult question is, can you do any job that exists in the national economy in reasonable numbers? Can you do this job? And you have to prove that there's no job that you can do. And that can be difficult. And while the administrators and the judges are going to listen to you, they're going to be courteous to you, and they're going to believe you, it takes medical evidence. And so this is particularly difficult for poor people who up until 2013, October 1st, or maybe January 1st, 2014, they don't have health insurance. And if you don't have health insurance, you can't go see a doctor. And if you can't go see a doctor, you don't have medical records. And this is going to change, but you've got to prove through medical records that there's no job you can do. And that's tricky, but doable.
So how do you do it? How do you solve this chicken and egg conundrum, I will say? Because, I mean, most people in this country get health care through either a government health insurance program that you first have to be found disabled for, or they get their insurance through an employer. They're working. And of course, if you're working, you're not applying for disability. So you don't have the usual sources of medical care or health insurance, yet you've got to have medical records to prove your disability. How do you get out of that conundrum?
Well, question number three in this five-part test is you must be unable to work for 12 consecutive months, or you must be able to prove that you're going to be unable to work for 12 consecutive months. And if you're in that situation, often you can get and qualify for something called VCC. There may be other programs. This is the one that I know the most because it's part of VCU. And for a very small amount each month, you can go to MCV VCU, and they'll provide you some medical care, and it produces medical records. Like I say, I think this is going to change in the future. People are going to find a way to qualify more often for Medicaid or some form of Medicaid, and they'll be able to get medical care, which will produce medical records.
So what type of medical conditions are most likely to lead to a favorable finding of disability for somebody who says, I can't work due to my condition?
I'm going to cut it in half. Physical conditions and mental conditions. Physical conditions, you've got to have a condition that limits your ability to sit. Maybe to sit and pay attention. Let's say you have a pain case. It's not a back case. It's not a arthritis case. It's not a fibromyalgia case. It's a pain case. You've got to prove that you have severe pain. Well, a doctor has to recognize that your pain is severe. Then what we need that doctor to say is to uncharacteristically talk in terms that Social Security understands. And that conversation that's momentary must match the medical records that the doctor or the hospital has been creating. So let's assume it's severe pain. The doctor says, yeah, this pain's terrible, severe. But it must be so severe that it prohibits you from maintaining, this is the key phrase, attention and concentration for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day on the simplest of job tasks on a sustained basis. Turns out, for the uninitiated, for the people who haven't been to medical school, and maybe even for doctors, it's sort of hard to know how severe your pain is. You have to tell us, and you have to act in a way that tells the doctor, the judge, somebody else that you have severe pain. Got to be in the medical records. And the judge has to be convinced. Usually it's a judge. The administrators don't like these kind of cases because they're ephemeral. You can't see it. And that's a problem.
And isn't it true for a pain case, you really can't measure it, at least not in the same way that you would measure, say, blood pressure or diabetes or heart function or lung function.
Right. If you have a heart, if your case is a cardiac case and your heart is pumping at 20% efficiency, they start writing you a check because it's an objective test and you can pass that. There are objective tests for pain, but as a practical matter, they just don't work in the context of Social Security disability. And so it takes a hearing, lots of medical records, maybe some kind of interview with the doctor. So one of the things I do for people is I have a series of questions about pain and that client's pain. And hopefully, some doctors answer these questions, some don't. The doctor answers the questions in a way that it convinces the judge that your pain is severe. Now, the other kind of case is a mental case, and it's really very similar to a pain case. You can't see mental disease. It's, again, ephemeral. But once again, you have to prove that your mental limitations or condition is such that you cannot maintain attention and concentration for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day on the simplest of job tasks on a sustained basis. And it's the medical records. It's what it says.
So who would be likely to document something like that mental condition that you described?
Psychiatrists are best. Judges want to see, administrators want to see the most knowledgeable person that they can find. Someone who, and for example, the opinion of a treating source, in this case a treating psychiatrist, they want to see that the psychiatrist has met with you at least 3 times. And they, if all the psychiatrist has done is review 3 meetings with a sociologist or a caseworker or something, it's not as good as the psychiatrist spent three different times meeting with you to determine that you have this severe mental impairment or whatever, now that psychiatrist's opinion rises to the level of a treating source. It's supposed to be given more weight than a non-treating source.
And you mentioned non-treating sources. I know that Social Security in the past, and I assume they continue to, from time to time, send claimants who have very few medical records to a consultative physician chosen by the Social Security Administration, whether for a physical exam, a mental status exam, possibly both. Do you find that happening? Do you find those reports to be helpful, harmful, somewhere in between? What's your experience with those?
There typically are two non-treating sources. One is a DDS, Department of Disability Services, an agency of the state of Virginia. This physician never sees you, reads the medical records at a very early stage in the process, and almost always makes a determination that, well, you're probably sick, but you could go to work. And it's just invariably that way. They do dozens, maybe even hundreds of cases in a very short period of time, and it's not much of a review. That's why the law basically says that should be given less weight. But when you don't have many medical records, it's the only weight. Now, the next kind of person is one you've alluded to, a doctor. It can be a PhD psychologist or a psychiatrist, who, and I believe the fee for this is $65. So success, this is being a little ugly, but successful psychiatrists and medical professionals, they may not do this as often as people who aren't as successful because it's not much money. And this person interviews you for a short period of time and writes a report. There's a particular form for the report. They go through a particular thinking process that they write down, and they reach a conclusion about your mental status. But again, this is someone who's only met you for half an hour or an hour. And their opinion, by Social Security standards, should weigh less than somebody who's seen you three times. But this weighing process is very arbitrary, my opinion, because I represent claimants, and is flawed, but it is what it is.
And how much weight do you think that the administrative law judges, the people that the claimant actually gets to meet face-to-face for their first and really only face-to-face meeting with a decision-maker, how much weight do the law judges give to actually the claimant's testimony?
Some. I don't know what some is, and of course it varies from case to case. And people make different presentations. People come in all shapes and sizes. Some people make a wonderful impression, and some people don't. And so it's subjective. Underlined subjective. And judges are given great latitude in looking at you and deciding what your status is. And you just got to live with that.
And what about other factors that could play into the disability determination, such as the claimant's age, the claimant's education, the claimant's work history? Those aren't medical factors, but they do come into play in terms of the decision. How is that accomplished?
The Social Security system is a grid based on age, leading to severity of impairments. And the older you are, the lower level of evidence you have to have to prove that you're disabled. So, for example, if you're 58, Social Security requires less evidence than if you're 41. You're 41, they want some really, really strong evidence. Sometimes we can find that, and sometimes we can't. Generally, the break point is age 50. Age 50, and things begin to get a little more relaxed. That's an overgeneralization, but people under 50 have a lot more difficult time and win fewer cases than people over 50.
And what about those other factors I mentioned, education and also your prior work history?
Well, question number four earlier I referred to five questions. Question number four is, the claimant must prove that they cannot, based on their medical situation, do any past relevant work. That is work that they did in the 15 years before becoming disabled. And so they look at those jobs and say, hey, can you, you worked in a convenience store for 6 months, can you do that again? You operated a jackhammer, can you do that again? And that's the claimant's burden. The burden is on the Social Security Administration to prove that you can't do any other job that exists in the national economy. I don't talk like that. And the reason is, as a practical matter, the claimant needs to focus on, there's no job I can do. You've got to be able to explain that in some way through the medical records, through your testimony. But technically, the burden is on the administration. But as a practical matter, the claimant has to prove it.
So do you ask the claimant to explain in some detail? Do you describe a easy job that's low exertion, low stress, and say, tell us why you couldn't do this job?
Sometimes. I try not to be that direct. I try to be a little sneakier than that. And so I might ask some other question. So let's say you have a diabetes case. You could have the worst case of diabetes known to man. You're probably not going to win. Uncontrollable diabetes is not enough to prove that you're disabled. It might be. It could be. That's not how it happens. But if you can prove that you have lower leg neuropathy, and this is a person who has diabetes, is typically out of control, and their lower leg swells up, this giant thing, and it's extremely painful. So what does the doctor tell you? The doctor prescribes raising your feet to waist level or higher for at least 2 hours a day. Bingo. It turns out in the DOT, Dictionary of Occupational Titles, a publication of the United States Department of Labor, they describe every job. No job is described that includes elevating your feet waist high for any amount of time, and certainly not for 2 hours a day. So it's sort of not a diabetes case. It's a got to raise your feet case.
And so you're really focusing not so much on the name that's put on the illness, but on the signs, the symptoms, how it affects their ability to function during the day, and in particular during a work day.
Exactly. And this comes as a surprise to people. People come to me and to other advocates of this kind of thing, and they say, look, I'm just terrible, and I'm just sick. I'm sick, sick, sick. Well, it takes more than that. You got to have some little signal that you absolutely can't. So, for example, a common job that I describe to the claimant now to explain how this process works is, I say, could you be an information clerk? An information clerk is someone who sits inside the front door at a big hospital or a big office building and says, oh, take elevator number 3, or Lawyer Jones is on the 5th floor. Well, that's not much of a job. You can stand up whenever you want to. You can move around. You can stretch. That is an incredibly simple job. And so we've got to prove that your particular, but you can't raise your feet in that job. You have to pay attention for 6 hours out of an 8-hour day in that job. You've got to stay focused, and that's how you begin to prove that a particular person can't do any job that exists. Now, there are other simple jobs, but that's one that sort of everybody quickly understands.
Well, thank you very much. We have been talking with Charles Crumbine, Crumbine and Associates, across the street from Willow Lawn Shopping Center, about Social Security and SSI disability and how to tell whether you've got a case worth pursuing or not. Thank you so much for being on the show, Charles.
Thank you.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. You can get free legal information at the statewide legal aid website. This is www.valegalaid.org. You also may get free pre-recorded legal information by phone during non-business hours. These are before 9 a.m., after 5 p.m., and on weekends and legal holidays. Call toll-free 1-866-534-5243. If you have any comments on the show, you can email them to marty@cvlas.org. In addition, every first-run Central Virginia Legal Aid radio show ever broadcast is available at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the numeral 4, all.net. Then click the contributor link, then click Marty Wegbright, Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Virginia is an employment at will state, but state and local government employees have rights which private sector employees lack. Join us next week at 12:30 p.m. when employment law attorney Mark Barron explains how he saves the careers of government employees through the effective use of grievance procedures. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.